You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine. Welcome to Sponsored. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week on the program, we have the most legendary skier of all time. I'm talking about the man with the mohawk, Glenn Plake, and we are going to find out all of Glenn's story, from arrests to sponsorships to what he is up to now. It's going to be a three-part series, as Glenn has a lot of stories to tell. We're going to start with the early days of Glenn Plake's career, and we'll start with Glenn right now.
Yeah, hey, how's this sound? I'm on a headset. Is that okay?
Yeah, you sound great.
I'm going to disappear for 1 second. Hold on. I'll be right back. Are you there?
I am here.
Hello? Okay, perfect.
Cool. Well, thanks for hopping on the call.
No problem.
Psyched to talk to you and want to tell your story from when you were a kid and bring that up through skiing. So going back, everybody knows who you are in skiing. Obviously, you're the most famous skier, I think, in the history of the sport. And at this point, you go to mainstream USA and people know, they don't know your name. You can say the guy with the mohawk and they know exactly who you're talking about.
That's right.
Definitely been a great piece of marketing for yourself and your personal brand. But it's also just created an image around skiing that it really needed, because when you came up, skiing was, I won't say dying, but it wasn't cool to the youth of America.
No, it was definitely one of the times in skiing's history. It's happened a couple of times where it kind of just, I don't know, falls on itself, I guess.
Yeah, and you resurrected that, created extreme skiing. I think it was USA Today.
Today's show.
Where that came up, that really just changed the game for skiing. I know a lot of kids, including myself, saw that. And it created a lot of fun within skiing that really wasn't there before. And then you see the stunt movies and it was game changing. But it all started in California for you. And was Lake Tahoe where you grew up skiing?
Yeah, I grew up in right there in South Lake Tahoe. Yeah, that was my hometown. And I grew up I got a couple details. I was actually born in Livermore because Tahoe didn't have a hospital. And first time I actually skied was up in Montana because my father was going to school up there. So the first time I actually slid down snow was apparently in the backyard while they were up in Missoula.
Okay.
And by age two, my father had graduated and my mother and him had decided to live in Lake Tahoe area, in Lake Tahoe specifically, South Lake Tahoe. That's where it all began. And then I joined the local ski club by age three and kind of went from there. Our race team was called the Heavenly Valley Blue Angels. So I was a Blue Angel. And then 3, 4, 5 years old. By 5 years old, I was definitely part of the ski program.
You're a Blue Angel, and that's, I would think, daycare for the parents as well. They drop you
pretty
off in the morning and pick you up in the afternoon.
Especially in those days, for sure.
Yeah, so it gets them either on the hill or doing whatever they need to do. And are you racing at that point, or is it just a ski program where you're figuring out skiing?
A couple of races a year, you know, kiddie cup stuff. It wasn't until I was probably 7 or so that you start, you know, thinking about racing or even really knowing about racing. I think I was 7 or so when you finally have your first race a couple times a year, you know.
And when you started those races, was that fun for you? Did you think racing was pretty cool?
I didn't really adopt to it too soon. I think I was just more into just skiing around, doing whatever at that point. Right when all that was going on was in the heart of the hot dogging movement.
Yeah.
So while racing was cool from a standpoint of you could see the racers and all, but at the same time, the hot dogging world championships was held in our ski area. You know, the local ski scene was peppered with, at the time, the biggest names of the day, skiing in and around Heavenly and skiing in and around Lake Tahoe. And then in the summertime, like Bill O'Leary and John Clendenin and these, you know, these legends of that era were in and around. They had their water ramps set up, you know, and they were doing flips into Lake Tahoe. And Genya Fuller was like training at the trampoline. We had this like trampoline place and I used to go jump on trampolines and should be there training. And, you know, I watched Bob Salerno win a car, you know, and I mean, just all these different things were taking place at the ski area and in and around the ski area. And my room was covered with posters, you know, that you would get from the freestyle competition, you know, because you're a little kid running around, you know, and the Vans are there. And,
yep.
You know, you're grabbing the swag from wherever. And so, yes, while I certainly was aware of racing and I was on the race team, I had a lot of distractions going on. And honestly, I didn't really see myself as a racer as much as I saw myself as growing up to be a professional hot dog skier.
And were you watching those movies at all, the Barrymore movies that were showing the early guys, the Bobby Burns and everyone?
Yeah, we had a typical ski town. You know, you had ski movies playing in the, you know, in the bar, or ski movies playing at the pizza parlor, or, you know, wherever it was. And, you know, we'd sit there for hours and watch, you know, watch those old films. And then, like I say, see it live too, because they were all living in South Shore and they were all skiing. I remember riding up the chairlift, you know, you're going up the chairlift on the gun barrel, and, you know, you're seeing at the time the best mogul skiers in the world skiing underneath us, you know?
Yeah. I got to think that that might make you question whether racing is the future for you.
Yeah, it wasn't really. I didn't really have it in me to be a racer. Of course, we enjoyed racing and we knew of it. And the World Cup came to our town and we watched that and all this. And our coaches were extremely talented. And the guest coaches that they would bring in were extremely talented. But no, I mean, honestly, I was in trouble with the race coaches many, many times for skipping practice and being caught out in the trees with some jump that we built, or, you know, trying to do something that we had seen, you know, at the hot dogging contest the weekend before. And, you know, I think we're a bit of a, in one way I fell, because I still know one of my race coaches quite well. And in one way I felt bad for him, because, you know, he's trying to build these little ski racers.
Right.
You know, he's a little Austrian guy, you know, Helmut Hüttenmeier was our old race coach.
Mm-hmm.
He caught us jumping off the chairlift. And they were, you know, obviously we got kicked off the team for a couple of weeks.
Right.
And we were laughing yesterday because Helmut brought in all our parents and we were just laughing. Could you imagine this happening in today's day and age? One of the parents who's a pretty big guy, I remember sitting him going, "Hey, Helmut, you know, I mean, come on, they're 12-year-old kids, you know, give it a break." And little Helmut was about 5'6", Austrian or blonde hair, blue eye little guy, who still taught until about a year ago, slammed his fist on the table and basically said, "Shut up. You're not here to talk. You're here to take these little brats home."
Yeah, that would not fly today.
No, I think Helmut would be out of a job the next morning. Yeah, there's so many funny stories on that. Rosie Mittermeier, the great ski racer, her son's really good now. She came to ski with us one time, and it was the first time we really noticed anybody leaning on their ski poles.
Okay.
So, like, the next day, we're all leaning on our ski poles, you know, right?
Yeah.
I mean, heck yeah, Rosie Mittermeier leaning on hers. So we're all hanging from our straps the way little racers do, and the way racers do. And Helmut comes up and says, "What are you guys doing?" We're like, "Nothing. We're ready for practice." And he goes, "Why are you leaning on your ski poles?" And we're like, "I don't know. I think somebody said, well, Rosie Mittermeier leaned on her ski poles." And I remember him hitting me in the back of the leg going, "You don't ski like Rosie Mittermeier. When you ski like Rosie Mittermeier, you lean on your ski poles. Now stand up." And to this day, you will probably not ever see me lean on my ski poles. Yeah, there's so many funny stories on that. So I was way more interested in trying to become a freestyler or a hot dogger, which would have been a heck of a plan, honestly, except when I finally got of age, let's say, to be, you know, a competitor. I mean, I'm talking young, you know, I'm a little kid when all this is
right.
going on. And all of a sudden you get to the age of it possibly happening in one way, shape, or another. And the reality is, you know, the hot dogging movement is completely killed by litigation. You know, they went from giving away 5 cars in one season to no tour at all. The no jumping signs start popping up everywhere. And really, all the innocence of skiing and all the, you know, freewheeling spirit of skiing is basically ripped out from underneath it, in my opinion, and goes into this incredibly, you know, stagnant, awful world or interpretation, which ultimately, unfortunately, we're still in, honestly. I mean, we've chipped at the frickin' foundation, but we haven't made a big difference, really, a little bit here and there. But anyways, all that's gone, and there's no such thing as anything freestyle or hot dogging at all. And now you're of age, and you're kind of just stuck out and on the rope, you know. It's like, well, wait a minute. Wasn't that long ago guys were, I mean, the women's tour had, I have a poster from the Colgate Women's Freestyle Tour, and it was $75,000 to win.
Damn.
You know?
Yeah, I never realized that litigation and insurance companies really were kind of the end of that movement. I just kind of thought it...
They destroyed everything. They destroyed it.
I learned something right there. I had no idea.
A guy got hurt in Vail and they sued Vail or something. So Vail actually killed it ultimately, from what I was told.
Well, I won't comment on that.
Once again, thanks a lot. Yeah, so anyways, that's kind of, yeah, my, let's say, influences of where I was as a junior skier. So yeah, then what happens to freestyle after that? Well, that's a long story, and certainly I have versions of it and could talk about it. But myself, that was my influence. I was on a ski team, no big deal. Was never really a fast racer, but kind of went through the motions. I had a lot of influence of just where I was and the time I was and the skiing that was taking place, and that left a big influence on me. And still to this day, I mean, that's still, I have a hard time thinking that I started anything really. I was just another link in the chain. And honestly, I argue with people a lot. I really don't think anything Tanner did was revolutionary. I really don't think anything that's going on today is revolutionary at all. It's simply extension of the hot dogging era.
When I think of skiing, I think of Bobby Burns as kind of one of the first guys to make it where you can get paid to not be a competitive skier.
Who still isn't in the Hall of Fame, by the way.
Yeah, well, the Hall of Fame is a very interesting thing that I totally don't understand. I mean, it took you till 2010 to get in there.
I said, until Bobby Burns is in here, I have a hard time going in, because it's kind of, again, is it safe to say that there's something called modern ski history? And that would be, let's say, you know, from the era of fiberglass skis and plastic boots, because honestly, that's my era. You know, that's when my ski history begins. That's when my history, you know, or association begins. And so, you know, we're so quick to throw away modern ski history as something that happened in the 70s or whatever, or even 80s. And I kind of like, modern ski history is what I have to go to find my values, I guess, and or opinions on the sport, because that's what they're all based off of.
And I think if the Ski Hall of Fame wants to get people to actually visit it, it's got to be more modern ski history and more of the plaques. And
that's why I was put in. And I think, you know, you're going to see Tanner in, or you're going to see Simon in, or you're going to see, you know, that era coming in next. You're going to see the great rail riders are going to go into the hall. I look forward to nominating one at some point. You know, so I had all that influence going on in and around me, and that skewed my vision of the sport. And when I saw it turning into what it turned into, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, you know, it turned into the golf and ski elk medallions at the Twin Oak, Twin freaking whatever Moose Lodge, and you know, everybody's wearing turtlenecks and Dale of Norway sweaters and looking like Ken and Barbie dolls. And unfortunately, that I didn't want to ski like that. I had seen all this other type of skiing take place, and literally poof, overnight, one season, it's gone. But I didn't want to let it go away, because that was what I wanted to do. That was the influence that I had, and I was going to continue with that.
Well, at that point, I think you started skiing bumps, and you had met up with Stump while you were bump skiing?
Yeah, well, so when you're – it's a great problem in our country, actually. And I ask the question a lot, and I'll never really get a clear answer. But park skiing is free. You know, these ski areas put all this time and energy and dollars and cents into the park.
Yep.
And it's free. It doesn't cost a dollar to go to the park. You know, okay, you got to have your lift ticket and whatever. But you just rage up, ski on into the park, right? You can session there and there's a whole scene going on and everything's great.
Yep.
So I have to ask the question, well, if the park is free, where's the free race hill? How come I can't just rock up to a race course and ski down it for free and session it all day long and just go have a blast and kick it at the race hill? Because that's what I'm into.
I guess there was NASTAR at one point, but that was still like a $2 entry.
You still had to pay. It was still a pain in the butt. You still had to be there at a certain time and get your entry in. I'm just talking about a race course that you can session.
I don't think it exists. I've never seen it.
No, it doesn't exist. Mammoth does it a couple of times in the year, and they literally actually have to put dye on the snow that says, "This is free. Come try it." It's just so pegged into everybody's brain that it cost. Well, I was a teenager. And unfortunately, when you're a teenager, it doesn't matter, and this happened to two of us, we were kind of late bloomers, so to speak, from a technical standpoint. All the people that were beating us when we were, let's say, in our racing years, never became the skiers, you know, the talents that we became, because we were kind of late bloomers. So now you're 15, 16, the programs are running out. First of all, mom and dad are not paying for 15 and 16-year-old programs.
Yep.
And quite frankly, 15, 16, 17-year-old programs, you're either on your way or you're definitely out. The program doesn't extend past that age.
Right.
That's right when I like started getting warmed up, but there's no place to train. No place to train, there's no way you can ever race. The one thing about racing is you have to have a race course.
Yeah.
Well, if you don't have a race course, how are you going to train? So we kind of was just sitting there in limbo for a little bit, and ultimately ended up entering a mogul competition that we had heard was going on, and a full-on alpine racer in my in my race sweater, you know, on my slalom skis, entered this competition and got third place and thought, huh, that was kind of fun. You know, and I kind of was exposed to a smoldering version of freestyle skiing. It wasn't hot dogging, because when hot dogging was killed, slowly but surely, Europe adopted it and kind of took it over, and it smoldered around in Europe, and slowly but surely, the World Cup had been formed. It was a homogenized version of the hot dogging era, without a doubt. But in fact, freestyle skiing was in fact still a viable form of competition, or kind of. So I was unaware of that. I could still use my USSA license. My designation was still alpine, but for the rest of that season, I competed in this mogul competitions, and ultimately found myself being qualified for nationals and placing top 10 in nationals. And, you know, all this taking place in my, literally my very, very first year of, you know, freestyle competition, so to speak, I guess.
Is that where you see a future? You're like, holy crap, I can do this?
Yeah, so all of a sudden, well, we didn't need a race course. I could train moguls because I grew up in South Shore. I raced for Heavenly when I was a kid, but I skied Kirkwood. We skied Mammoth, you know, bunch of Kirkwood powder, you know, on and on and on. We were travelers. The one thing growing up in South Shore, you tend to ski a bunch of ski areas and not one. And the beauty was, is I could train moguls anywhere, because at that time, the mogul courses were still simply moguls. I just needed to go ski moguls. I could train moguls. And Darren Johnson was a friend of mine that I grew up skiing with. And he kind of was also in the same situation. You know, he was a better racer than I was, but he was definitely my ski partner. And the two of us would train and show up to these bump competitions and do quite well. I had another guy named Charlie Hudak, who I used to ski with that time, and he was more advanced than we were technically, but he showed us kind of a way, and then we capitalized on that. And I'm proud to say that I ski moguls unlike any mogul skier there is. During my years in Japan and skiing in some of the competitions in Japan, you know, I was always given special recognition for my skiing technique, because it was quite different than whatever anybody else was doing at the time, and is still. I still ski moguls unlike anybody else. I mean, talk to Johnny about it. We talk about my skiing all the time. It came from racing. It came from the idea that we were always skiing our big. So we'd ski on our big skis kind of in spite, just to make it more difficult for ourselves. And it was, it just developed a technique that I'm very, very proud of. And I love sharing with people, because I do ski differently.
Yeah, it's something that I need to see, because in thinking about it, you created such an image around yourself during your ski career, especially in the latter parts. You know, the image of Plake the Ambassador and everything that you stood for. Sometimes people maybe didn't see the skiing as much as they just looked at you as the personality. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that gets forgotten because you're such a great guy and you have so many stories and you're just thinking about Blizzard of Oz, Maltese Flamingo, all those movies. And some of that stuff gets overlooked. And one thing is, there's not a ton of video of you skiing online, and it'd be great to get a clip of your bump style just to see it, because I mean, I know of your skiing forever, but I can't think of you ripping a bump line. So it's interesting just how your image and personality has taken over, and I think at some points in your career that kind of got in the way of really the skiing, at least the people thinking about the skiing and seeing the skiing.
You know, certainly the, you know, having my hawk up and doing the different things, you know, it certainly brings attention to the sport, not just my skiing, but like you said at the beginning, it brings attention to the sport. And then my skiing is, you know, kind of my skiing. I do my thing, you know.
Yeah. So back to when you're a teenager, I think of Glenn Plake and I see the hawk. I think of counterculture and just a different kind of person. What were you actually really like as a teenager?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, were you like F authority and I'm doing it my way?
Or? I grew up in a gambling town. So drugs and alcohol was part of our life quickly and early. And so we were playing around with that. And then, obviously I was very athletic, whether it was my water skiing in the summertime or my snow skiing during the wintertime or my bicycle riding in between. I had a lot of natural athletic abilities just as a kid. You know, I didn't stop at all. And then, at the same time, I was kind of stuck in this. A couple of the guys that I grew up with went on to become musicians and start some of the more influential punk rock bands of our time. And we were skating a lot. We had two huge ramps that we built. So we had the skate scene, and all this was taking place in and around the thrash band era of post-punk rock, in between skate scene and the music scene, and obviously way before mass communication that we have now. So everything was kind of word of mouth. Everything was kind of, without a doubt, you know, underground / counter culture, whatever the heck. And unfortunately, because around this same time, I had this newfound path of possibly achieving a spot on the U.S. ski team as a freestyle skier or as a mogul skier, this opportunity came up. Unfortunately, this opportunity came up with the fact that, especially during those times, back to this kind of Ken doll analogy, I mean, you know, it was the U.S. ski team. Your hair had to be perfect. You had to have all this perfect rep. And I mean, it was just kind of gross, actually. It was kind of what skiing had become. They were worried about perfectly folded turtleneck and the golf horse and all this crap.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with skiing, honestly. And here we were trying to play the game, but it wasn't working out, you know. We were just talking about two-faced. I mean, you're putting on smiley, happy face, you know, trying to be polite for the USSA crowd. And meanwhile, I'd been up all night long the night before the competition at a Social Distortion concert, going crazy all night. And then it was like, oh, cool, freshen up and make myself look like Mr. US ski team member. I just kind of finally got sick of it, actually, and said the heck with it. And I just quit kind of acting, I guess. A couple things were kind of helped lead to that. I mean, we polluted poor freaking Brad Holmes. I mean, they, you know, little Bradley comes out as this child prodigy, and he had a pretty interesting upbringing because he was out of Salt Lake City, and part of his, you know, kind of step family, adopted family, was pretty heavy into the punk rock scene in Salt Lake. So he had all this going on, but he was kind of living in it too. And then he comes out to ski in California and, you know, runs into me and Palmer and kind of goes, oh, those guys look kind of cool, you know, and all of a sudden he's hanging out with the wrong crowd immediately.
Right.
At the same time, Hatrip and his buddies had come down from Pacific Northwest. And while they weren't totally like in the punk rock scene, they were kind of Jockorama frat boys.
Okay.
And it was like accepted that they had like shaved their heads and became like whatever. I remember Hatrip shaving his head to like some funny like bowl cut or something. And it was like accepted because, like I said, they were kind of like Jockorama frat boys.
Okay.
And we weren't. We were little derelict losers from South Shore. So like if we showed up with friggin' shaved heads, it's like drug addicts.
Right.
Which may have been true, none of their business. But the reality is I just kind of was over it. At the same time, I was having a bit of an epiphany that the U.S. ski team was probably not my path after all.
Right.
And I kind of just gave up on the whole thing and just started skiing and doing what the hell I wanted to do for myself. And so I just quit, you know, quit putting on my smiley face on Saturday's forum, skied in the same leather jacket I was wearing all the time anyways, and kind of let my hair go wild. Yeah, heck with them. And then about the same time, Stumps Films, you know, had made their debut. And fortunately for me, Mike Hatrip, you know, was one of the skiers in those early films. Jeff Stump, I knew from going to Nationals. It was a direction that fit me. That was kind of less, it was my next step was to ski in a ski film away from the judges. I needed to be a part of that. It was time to be a part of some sort of a production. And Hatrip kind of did some lobbying. Jeff Stump did some lobbying, and the next thing you know, it was looking like I was gonna ski in one of their films. And so they came out to California and, on a spring, and I got to. And Greg was terrified of me. Everybody was terrified of me. I mean, I'd been in and out of jail that already. I wasn't really thinking too much about my own future at that time.
That's what young people do, though.
Yeah, exactly. What for? Skating a lot. Skating really helped me, let's say, develop my style in a way, skiing-wise, because I loved skating and I could skate and I was completely passionate, but I wasn't really that great. I mean, I could big old slap grinds and I could do my airs and I could do my thing, but I wasn't like super gifted in the ramp. So skating to me, and I traveled all over. I mean, we'd go down and watch Hawk in his early years down in Del Mar. I mean, we'd go to SF and skate, do the whole SF scene. And we had pro contest up in North Shore. Anyways, all this was going on. That one thing I was really good at was my skiing. And the skating that I couldn't necessarily do, I was able to do while I was on my skis. So it was kind of cool. I really enjoyed, say, living the fantasies on my skis that I couldn't necessarily do during the summertime. Same thing took place with riding motorcycles. I mean, I love my motorcycles. I've had the pleasure of competing and doing all these different things on my motorcycles. But the reality is I never really got the gift, but I would take the wants and needs, you know, while I'd ride my motorcycles, and then come wintertime, I'd make it reality.
And at that point, I kind of look at it as that's where the torch has been passed from the hot doggers to, we'll say, the skiers of the extreme, or whatever Stump would call that.
Gosh, we could talk hours about the early films, you know, Maltese and the crew and the people and everything that made that film. And it's awesome. I absolutely love it. And yes, I think you're right to say at that point, not only was the torch passed, but the eyes were opened to people that went, hey, wait a minute. I don't want to ski like those people. I want to ski like those people, which is exactly the same thing that happened to me going to the hot dogging contest as a kid. I didn't want to ski like my race coach. I wanted to ski like Bob Salerno. You know, obviously we had Wayne Wong posters. I wanted to ski like, you know, like those guys. I just think it opened everybody's eyes back up to something that they, and I can't even say they forgot about it, because they didn't know about it. And that's why I think we're given credit for pioneering things. You know, the fire was smoldering. It was just, we fanned it finally, and then everybody walked up to get warm.
Great analogy. I mean, I look at it as what Bobby Burns and those guys did back in the early days, and the ability to be a skier and not race and get paid, that was almost tapering off until you and your crew came back in and made that happen again. And all the free skiers today have to look back to you as, hey, he kept that going for us, and these guys are keeping it going for the next generation. You don't have to be a racer.
Yeah, the only liaison in between there was, you know, the brief stint of, like say, the Pro Mogul Tour, where you had Joey Cordo. You had the, because this guy was an amazing skier, huh? You ever heard of Joey Cordo?
I've heard the name, but I can't say that I know anything more than the name.
Mind-boggling. Snow skier from Sun Valley. There was kind of a Sun Valley mogul crew. There was a bit of a snowbird mogul crew, you know, with that group. But Cordo was the real standout of that era. Lane Parrish, badass, dude, badass. Lane Parrish and Cordo, no one will ever know their names. Those were the guys that held on during the darkest of years. That was like a little bit of a band-aid that tied the two things together. And the beauty about Cordo was he had the whole freestyle, you know, the hot dogging era as, you know, as his base. And again, so much of our skiing was done in spite for validation. You know, we were never skiers. We were never any good. There was an article in Powder about me and Hattrip not being technically good skiers. I remember there was this like point counterpoint thing that we just giggled our heads off. And Cordo really became a technical mogul skier. He was beautiful to ski watch. I mean, absolutely amazing. There were others part of that group too. But anyway, so blah, 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 I got off track. That was the only thing in between hot dogging and let's say our debut.
I was around at that point, not really part of the core of the industry. I did know there was a mogul tour going on, but it didn't get the attention of hot dogging or what you were doing either. It was there and it was the band-aid to take you to the next level, but it still didn't have that exposure that you were able to bring, that the hot doggers were able to bring, and really put skiing on the map as, hey, it is not all about race. You can go out there and be yourself and enjoy skiing.
Yeah, I just think people... even today, dude, I sit here and I'm at my mother-in-law's house and she happens to get a couple of ski magazines. And just this morning while you were getting ready to call me, I looked through it and I'm sad to say that after all these years, I feel like I've actually accomplished nothing. Because I just went flipping through this magazine going, there is nothing that I want to have to do with anything in this publication at all. Nothing. It has no representation of me or what I do on my skis at all.
Now, if you were to look at a magazine when you were a kid and you looked at, you know, a bunch of race images, would you have said the same thing? I mean, do you think kids...
No, there was like a few moments here and there, but there's like an old scene of all of us back in Blizzard of Oz flipping through the magazines. Going, you know, like critiquing each page of the magazine.
Yeah.
It's funny. We've really gone nowhere. For a while there, I think we had some changes going, but honestly, it's fallen straight back into the same old rut. It's trippy, actually.
At some point, you're filming with the stump. You've already done the Maltese Flamingo, and you broke your leg and had to take 2 seasons off.
Yeah, that was funny because that was a bit of a setback for many, many different reasons. So, yeah, I didn't know what or who or where we were trying to be. So, yeah, we finished filming Maltese. Everything's great. You know, wasn't like we made any money or anything, but I was going to be in a ski film. There's no doubt about it. You know, I had some sort of validation of everything that I've been kind of do. And to the judges and to the people that had said, that guy's bad news and stay away from him and on, all of a sudden I'm kind of in this ski movie and it was like, oh my gosh, you know, here we go. And it was something incredibly positive, you know, as far as for the first time in my world, I guess, I was where I was there all of a sudden. It was like, oh my gosh, you know, this is what we're supposed to be doing. You know, everything in life had always been not working out that well. And all of a sudden, whoa, this is exactly what's supposed to be happening. I feel very natural here, incredibly natural feeling. No, not out of place in any way, shape, or form.
How does your family react to this? Are they just super proud of you? And like,
so, you know, whatever. My dad's kind of cracking up going, yeah, whatever, you know. My parents were actually divorced when I was 2. So I lived with my mom until I was in my teenager years. And then I ended up moving in with my dad. And yeah, dad kind of tells his version of a story at one point where he basically just kind of comes in and says, you can live the way you want to live and do whatever you do. And that's great. But you can't do it while you're living here. And he kind of tells the story best. But anyways, apparently my reaction was, okay, yeah, I understand. And I basically left that afternoon and, you know, came back a couple years later. Like, no big deal. Okay, cool. Yeah. And I basically was like, okay, yeah, cool. I understand. All right, hang on. Then give me a few hours to get my crap out of here.
So what you're doing was really cool as long as you weren't living at home.
Yeah. Hey, one funny thing about that Maltese, since we were talking about the Maltese deal, you know why there's no mogul skiing of me and Malt in that quintessential spring slush mogul segment in Maltese?
Why?
With Scotty Ogren wearing my jacket because he didn't have anything to wear and he's wearing my jacket and all that. I am not in that segment because I was not allowed to get on the lift at Squaw Valley. I was stopped at the lift because of some cocky SOB freaking lift operator who I do in fact know, but will go unnamed. But
okay.
He was looking for his time on film because you want some real skiers. I'll get off work at 3.
Right.
Anyways, yeah, as we all got on the lift, because it was hot spring slushy moguls, I had put my hawk up and had my leather jacket on. And as I got to the lift, Christian Schneider, who at the time was a photographer Everybody's getting on the lift. I slide up to the lift. They slide out to me and say, we can't let you on the lift. I go, what are you talking about? You know, we're up here filming. And they said, yeah, you're not really the type of image that we would like to represent of this segment at Squaw Valley.
That's such bullshit.
I was not allowed to get on the lift. And that's why I am not in the mogul skiing segment of Maltese Flamingo. It's that simple. I was denied access.
That's ridiculous. Yeah. And today they just love it. They'd be like, yeah, no, we want you in this part of the segment.
Which is kind of funny. And it's funny because I am from the South Shore.
Yeah.
And, you know, we kind of grew up hating freaking North Shore anyways. And I don't hold too big of a grudge, but I do keep it kind of close to my heart, the whole North Shore, South Shore rivalry. I think rivalries are a great thing.
Yeah, I think they are too.
And I looked at him like, you really? You really? And they were like, yep, you can't get on this lift. And I was just like, that's pretty typical. I've been dealing with you freaking knuckleheads since we were little kids. You know, they had the Olympics and we had casinos.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
So anyways, I came back and I hitchhiked all the way back from that sand dune that we were filming the sand skiing on.
Okay.
Got a hold of Darren Johnson. Told him some stories. Come on, let's go skiing. We ended up hooking up with Chris Thompson, who's another skier I grew up ski racing with. And we went out, and it was last day at Kirkwood, and we're going to go like heck and have a good ski day. And we had been playing around with skiing the Heart Bowl that year, which was kind of it was a little project that we finally got done. And funny little kind of Kirkwood's version of chimney sweep at Squaw type thing. And come on, let's go blast the Heart real quick. It's last day of the year, last run of the year. And it was a typical California spring day. We had had about 5-6 inches of snow the night before. And I went in there and pulled a little pocket of snow out, and kind of just as I was getting ready to kind of get over the little jump crux thing of this thing, I got hit by it and took me off my feet and pounded me through a choke, basically, and should have killed me, but it ended up just breaking my femur.
Damn. And so that was a full 2 years off the snow?
Yeah, so it was last day of the year.
Okay.
So you don't ski at all the next year, and then you go all the way around, and you finally ski again the following year. So a little more than 18 months, yeah.
Were you worried that you wouldn't be able to ski again, or you just figured, I'm going to power through this?
No idea. I had rods and pins sticking out of me for a long, long, long time. And yeah, I was moving around doing my things, but I definitely had some interesting hardware sticking out of my leg for a long time. And when that hardware finally came out, it looked like things were going to be better. The doctors had told me that I'd be pretty good, but I sure didn't. You know, I wasn't completely confident just because of the hardware and being down. I broke it 2 inches above my kneecap.
Okay.
2 days later, a buddy of mine crashes his motorcycle and he breaks his femur in kind of more of a normal area.
Uh-huh.
And he's like walking around like a month or two later, and I was still basically bedridden and wasn't even allowed to put the quote unquote, I don't want you putting your toe down in the morning when you take a piss. I was no weight bearing for over 3 months. And anyways, on and on. In the long run, it probably really helped me out because when it was time to ski again, there was no question whatsoever in any way, shape, or form that I was back and ready to ski. I use this a lot when I'm talking to people that have been hurt or recovering from an injury. People just, they try too soon, too fast. And I had the liberty of taking a long time there, and I have virtually no side effects whatsoever. My structure is different on one side than the other because of the break. I have a different muscle structure on my right leg than my left leg. It's really funny when my bike racing buddies get together because they're just like, what in the heck is wrong with you? Because I clearly have different muscle groups and modifications from the body adjusting to the new alignment. No, I've had no structural issues whatsoever at all from the break, but it did take a long time to heal. And then by happen chance of the environment, you know, the fact that it was last day of the year, it gave me that extra 6, 7, 8, 9 months to not be on skis and possibly re-injure it or get in too early or make a mistake. I don't know. It worked out good.
And then from there, you get better. And is your next move heading overseas to film Blizzard?
A lot happened in those 18 months. I ended up getting busted in a heck of a lot of trouble, actually, from that one. Because, you know, you're trying to get by. And so you're selling a few illegal items on occasion.
Yep.
And I end up getting busted with a felony transportation, felony possession, felony sales, felony intent to sale, on and on and on. I just went on and on and on.
So I guess you're not voting this year?
Yeah, and I've never voted ever. I was arrested when I was 19, so I've never, ever voted. Isn't that funny? Yeah, I end up doing 6 months. I'm in, I'm out, all sorts of stuff's going on. And really, the only light of day was the possibility of getting back on the train where I left off. And that was to, you know, get back into a stump film. Greg wanted nothing to do with me because of all the, they weren't rumors, the truth of what was going on in my personal life.
Right.
But fortunately, I had a Hattrip on my side. I had Kennett on my side. I had a guy named Carl Labby, who at the time was Greg's kind of marketing director. I had Bruce Benedict on my side. They had informed me that they would be filming at Snowbird, Utah. And they told me where they were staying and when I was going, and basically kind of said, that's the info. It's up to you to do with what you want to do with it. And I went, I basically just took off, and kind of the same way I went to film with Maltese. I went to my buddy's rental shop because I knew I was going to need K2s because they were sponsored by K2, and I didn't have any K2s at the time. So I borrowed a pair of K2s. I knew that would be skiing on Salomon boots. I was skiing on Reikley at the time. I sold a pair of Reikley so that I'd have gas money to get out to Snowbird. Went to a rental shop who rented my buddy's rental shop, and I grabbed some Salomon freaking rental boots. And I was already sponsored by SOS, so I had the clothing, and I went out and showed up and basically knocked on their door and said, hey, what's going on? Here I am. You know, what time you got to start filming?
And what'd they say? Like, holy shit, how do you get here?
Pretty much, yeah. But the same thing kind of happened during the Maltese thing too. You know, when they filmed at Squaw years ago, that first time I met Squaw, that was the same deal. I'm on all rental gear on that too.
You wouldn't see a pro today get on rental gear.
Well, you know, back then the films were sponsored by different equipment companies, and if you weren't on that equipment, they didn't really appreciate you being in the film, or, you know, so I didn't want to take any chances.
Gotcha. Glenn, I think this is a great point. If you're willing to do like probably two more interviews, because you just have so much to say, and we've gotten up to the point in your life where it's about to take off for you.
Yeah, without a doubt. I'm more than happy with chit-chatting about these. You know, a lot of people are trying to get me to freaking write a book, but, you know, whatever. I'm still alive and well and working, and if you want to, yeah, do it. I'm cool with it. I don't care. I think it's funny.
Yeah, I'd like to do one in November, talking about the point in your career where it all starts to take place, the Chamonix days, mm-hmm. And then maybe one in December, talking about what you're doing now, really, because like I said earlier, I think your skiing gets lost a little bit mm-hmm. because of your personality and what you've become in skiing. So I think we really need to talk about the skiing, too, because you're a badass skier, and while everybody knows that, mm-hmm. they might not know the extent of what you're doing in mountaineering, and I also have to talk about the Guatemalan Persuader at some point.
I mean, you know, over this last hour, I've had a lot of factuals that I wouldn't mind telling some funny stuff along the way for sure.
Yeah, I think it'd be great. I want to thank you for coming on. It's been an hour of just awesomeness, and
thank
I know
you.
Everybody's going to love hearing just your story because it's in detail where I think no one really knows your upbringing and ski upbringing. Now we do, and mm-hmm. we're going to find out about your whole life moving forward. Glenn, I want to thank you for coming out. We're going to have you on again and find out the next chapter of your life. It's always fun to catch up, and we will talk soon.
Can't wait. It's funny. It's like all my childhood dreams have come true, so it was fun to talk about them. Thanks.
Nice, man. Well, thank you. How awesome is Glenn Plake? And we have a ton more of Glenn Plake over on Inappropriate Questions on thepowellmovement.com. Glenn will tell us all the details about his arrest, and it was shock sport than Glenn Plake. I want to thank you for listening to Sponsored, brought to you by Powder Radio. I'm your host, Mike Powell. Next week, we will have Cody Townsend on the show. If you want to give me any show feedback, feel free to reach out, PowellMovement1 on Twitter, or Mike@thepowellmovement.com. Thanks again, and have a great week.